Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Still to come on our show today, West Side Story in prison. As you just heard on the news, the New York Philharmonic has made a notable and potentially healthy turnaround from its recent succession of older conductors. It's hired a 40-year-old named Alan Gilbert as its next music director. The appointment takes effect in 2009. Gilbert is currently the music director of the Stockholm Philharmonic, from which he'll step down next year. He's already resigned as music director of the Santa Fe Opera this past May. So what can we expect from an Alan Gilbert directorship at the Philharmonic? Joining us with his views is Justin Davidson, classical music and architecture critic of Newsday. Justin, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Hello, John. Nice to be here.
So Alan Gilbert, 40 years old. Outgoing conductor Lauren Mizell is 77. Court Mazur was 74 when he left in 2002. Do you think Alan Gilbert's relative youth will be an asset to the New York Phil?
Well, we should put relative youth in perspective. Leonard Bernstein, Zubin Mehta, Pierre Boulez were all in their 40s when they took over. So we're going back to, an earlier time in that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the kind of stunning vote for youth that the Los Angeles Philharmonic selection of Gustavo Dudamel, who's only 26, was.
So, but do you think that that having seen L.A. snap up this very gifted young Venezuelan conductor and the accruing press, publicity that went along with that, did that kind of force the New York Philharmonic's hand, in a sense, to pick someone younger and not one of the more established older conductors out there?
Well, I think that, this has been in the works in a way for some time. They were pursuing Riccardo Muti, who's in his 60s, and, Alan Gilbert's been conducting them a lot, and he was definitely on the short list. So I don't think they're moving, dramatically in response to the L.A. Philharmonic's move. I think it's sort of a little bit more deliberate than that. The age of the conductor is, an important thing to newspapers and critics. I'm not sure that it's so important to the administration, although, being able to invest in somebody who's has the potential of being around for a long time and isn't perceived as an interim person, that I think is important.
Well, not only not an interim person, but a member of the New York Philharmonic family. Alan Gilbert is the son of two longtime Philharmonic musicians. His dad is now retired. His mom is still in the orchestra there. How do you think that's going to play out?
Well, I asked him, I interviewed him in March, and asked him just about what it was like to conduct your mom. and he said, at first he was fairly self-conscious about it, but it gradually just became normal, and his authority was not questioned. I think more important in a way than having your mother sitting there amid the violins voicing more silent criticism perhaps than usual is just that he really grew up with that orchestra and he's really known it since his childhood. And so there's a relationship, a kind of collective relationship that goes back years and years.
We're speaking with Justin Davidson, the Pulitzer Prize-winning classical music critic at Newsday, about the New York Philharmonic's announcement, which was made official just actually about half an hour ago, that Alan Gilbert, 40 years old, will be the new music director, the next music director of the New York Phil, taking effect in 2009. His credentials seem solid. As you say, Justin, he sort of grew up with the orchestra, trained at Juilliard. The Stockholm Philharmonic, which he is currently the music director of, is a long-established orchestra with an international reputation. So, he's got a good resume. What kind of programming can listeners look forward to? Do you think it'll be a little bit more adventurous than it has been in the past?
I hope so. I've heard him do, the most impressive things I've heard him do have been very complex 20th century scores. I heard him do a fantastic performance of Ives' Fourth Symphony, which is one of those enormous, sprawling pieces that really not that many conductors can do justice to. And he just had absolute control over it. It was clear that this is really music that he, has a really innate sense of and relationship to. And the Ligeti Violin Concerto with Christian Tetzlaff, which is also very complex, and he was really able to carry that off with a great deal of panache. So I would hope that his tastes and inclinations, you know, align with his talents, and we'll see more of that. But, you know, that's a little bit hard to know. It should be said, Lauren Mazel can carry off that kind of intensely complicated score better than just about anybody on the planet, and yet he doesn't particularly seem to care to.
Yeah. Well, in fact, the music we heard coming in was Alan Gilbert conducting a recorder concerto by the contemporary composer Daniel Burtz. And his recorded legacy is pretty thin. You know, that part of his resume is, well, it's almost non-existent. There are very few recordings of Alan Gilbert.
Well, I mean, that's pretty much true of most conductors his age, because, it's no longer true that conductors, as they come up through the ranks and as they acquire prestige, also acquire recording contracts. He's had to kind of patch things together on the recording front. But it's also interesting that he really kind of made his career in Europe. You know, he's been living in Stockholm for quite some time. And so this is sort of a return to the United States. His American career, he's been making the rounds of the major U.S. orchestras, but only in relatively recent years.
Mm-hmm. And Alan Gilbert has, as you mentioned, been conducting the New York Philharmonic with some regularity over these last few seasons. In fact, the Philharmonic had two or three younger, and I'll use that word in quotes, I mean, for classical conductors, younger conductors, almost on a kind of a rotating tryout basis, right? I mean, you had David Robertson.
It was curious. I mean, there really seemed to be kind of a horse race going on.
Yeah.
And they announced some time ago when they when Lauren Mazel re-upped for another couple of years, that David Robertson and Alan Gilbert would also be conducting regularly. And it was pretty clear that they were sort of both in the running. How that played out behind the scenes, I'm not really sure. But, there's no real big surprise here. What is interesting is that they went for somebody who has a very, very good reputation professionally among orchestras, among administrators, among people who watch the music world. But he's not really a household name. Not that it's easy for any conductor to have that anymore. But he really, I don't know that he has his public in New York. He's going to have to grow into being a public figure here as well as a very well-respected musician.
Well, now, Justin, maybe this is a good question to leave it, because to me, it's not about how old or how young the conductor is. It's about how involved he or she will be in the community. And as you mentioned, Alan Gilbert, he's been living and working in Sweden. His family, you know, his wife and kids are living there in Stockholm. They have not announced that he's actually going to move to New York. Don't you think that that's kind of an important part of the position?
I think it is, but I also think that Alan Gilbert really is a New Yorker. I interviewed him at a cafe around the corner from the apartment he grew up in. He was staying with his parents on his last visit to New York, having given up a little apartment that he rarely visited. These are neighborhoods he knows well, and has a lot of allegiance to New York. Whether, you know, conductors lead complicated international lives, whether he maintains a home in Sweden or not is not necessarily crucial. I think he will certainly be a presence here.
All right, Alan Gilbert has been announced as the next music director of the New York Philharmonic, their 25th in their illustrious and long history. The appointment takes effect in 2009, and we've been speaking with Justin Davidson, classical music and architecture critic of Newsday. Justin, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, John.
West Side Story premiered on Broadway in 1957, and that very same year, the man who wrote the music, Leonard Bernstein, was named music director of the New York Philharmonic. Coming up next, West Side Story turns 50 and is being used to fight gang crime. We'll learn how.
here to keep clean. I like the shores of America. Comfort is yours in America. Now the adults in America. Wall to wall roads in America.
Well, they like the shows of America, but the shows of America have moved from the stage to a maximum security prison. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. West Side Story, the classic musical of two rival New York gangs, is turning 50 this year, but instead of big anniversary productions, it has been staged by a gang prevention program in Seattle and by inmates at the Sing Sing Maximum Security Correctional Facility upstate in Ossining, New York. Today we'll discuss the use of West Side Story as a social tool. And we'll start with Roxy Torres. She's a 16-year-old who participated on the West Side Story project in Seattle. Roxy, welcome to the program.
Hi.
So this is a musical that really predates you. I mean, it was from 1957. You watched the film version from 1961. Did you find that it was relevant?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I read Romeo and Juliet, so it's basically that.
And so what about it still kind of speaks to you as a teenager living in Seattle, you know, 50 years later?
I mean, it's almost like discrimination now, like with sexism, racism, and how a lot of people just hold you back on things.
So you're of Filipino ancestry, right?
Yeah.
So the racial issues, that was something that you responded to when you saw the film?
Almost. More like sex, like a certain sex.
Hmm. Just sex in general, or just the fact that, you know, the kind of forbidden nature that
yes.
One of the jets and one of the sharks or...
It's something like that.
Okay. Now, had you heard West Side Story before, the music, or had you encountered the story in any way?
What do you mean?
Before you went into this program, this
Have
project.
Have you ever watched it?
No. I mean, had you ever heard the music?
No.
Okay. So when you went there, I mean, first of all, you live in the south end of Seattle, right?
Yes, I do.
Now, that's apparently, you know, after the central area of the town, that's the one that has the most problem with crime. Is gang crime a problem in your neighborhood?
Yeah, it is. And, like, drugs and everything.
So the story here with West Side Story, you've got two gangs. I mean, you know, you're talking about gangs 1957. Did it ring true or did it seem kind of hokey to you at that point? Did the film teach you something about gangs you didn't already know from living there?
Not really. I mean, sure, it taught me just in a different kind of view.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's always like different views from everything, so...
All right, well, we've got, you know, you've got the Jets and the Sharks, whites and Puerto Ricans on the streets of New York, and, you know, one of the big issues in the stage version and the film version is this racial tension between the white kids and the Puerto Rican kids. Here's a scene from the movie version of West Side Story, which this scene begins with the police arriving to stop a fight between the two.
Hey, you, get down!
But we're having such fun.
We enjoy the playground.
See, it keeps us deprived children off of the foul city streets.
Shut up.
And born like we was in the hot pavement.
You want to get your skull broke?
Hey, baby John, come here. Come here. All right. Now, which one of these Puerto Ricans blooded you? Huh?
Well, sir,
Which one?
Excuse me, sir. As a matter of fact, we had suspicion that the job was done by a cop.
Two cops?
At the very least.
Impossible.
In America, nothing is impossible.
All right, wise guys. Now you listen to me. All of you. You hoodlums don't own these streets. And I've had all the roughhouse I'm going to put up with around here.
You want to kill each other?
Kill each other. But you ain't going to do it at my beat. Are there any questions?
Yes, sir. Would you mind translating that into Spanish?
That is from West Side Story with lyrics by Stephen Sondheim, music by Leonard Bernstein. And we're talking with Roxy Torres, a 16-year-old who participated in the West Side Story project in Seattle. Now, Roxy, you know, you've got two gangs here in the film, but in a sense, the real heavies, the real bad guys, seem to be the cops and the way they treat the various kids. The Seattle police were involved in setting up this whole project that that you took part in.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how did that play out? I mean, you know, what do the kids in your neighborhood think of the police? What did they think before, and has this project changed their minds?
Well, a lot of people, like, who was on the team advisory council with me, they, like, some thought, like, they were very intimidating. Like, for me, example, I did, like, my two encounters with, like, the police were, like, ooh, yell, or something like that, or got kicked out somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm a kid or something. And all the other people were like, oh, I just never really, like, seen and, like, I never really, like, encountered one.
Uh-huh.
And, like, after that, like, some people just, like, realize that they're not really bad at all. I mean, there's a lot of stereotypes against them. So it was like...
All right, so there's stereotyping going on in both directions, and you sit people down in a room, and you have something to talk about.
Yeah, it was like, well, no, I don't know. All I heard, like, you know, the police, like, the PD would just be, like, talking about how, like, they want, like, the best for us. And, you know, like, being teenagers that we are, we'll be, like, rebellious towards that. And
rolling your eyes. And that.
Yeah,
I know how that goes. All right, Roxy Torres is with us on the phone from Seattle, but we're also joined now by Catherine Vokens, who is founder of the organization called Rehabilitation Through the Arts. Now, she and her organization staged West Side Story with inmates at Sing Sing Prison. Catherine, you've done lots of productions over 11 years. West Side Story was your first musical. Why the decision to do a musical, and why make it West Side Story?
Thank you, John. I'm delighted to be here. Well, it's mainly because the superintendent at Sing Sing, the man who is now commissioner of New York State Correctional Services, Brian Fisher, in the 7 years that he was superintendent, had always said to us after we had done a production, that was a terrific production, I really appreciate that, when are you going to do a musical? And he kept that up kind of year after year with a nice gentle smile. I mean, he really liked what we did. We do original work the men themselves have written, and we frequently do a published piece like One Flew Over a Cuckoo's Nest or A Few Good Men or 12 Angry Men. But he would always say, this is terrific, but, you know, what about a musical? And so when he decided to retire, which he really didn't do, he then became the commissioner of New York State, a Spitzer appointee, but we thought he was going to retire. We said, okay, we'll do a musical. And we'll do his favorite musical, which was West Side Story.
And what was the inmates' reaction when you upped the ante, where it's, hey, guys, you're not just going to be out there talking. Now you've got to sing and dance as well.
Well, they were actually, our men were pretty cocky at the moment because we had just finished Oedipus Rex, and that was an incredibly difficult piece to do. And they did it brilliantly, even according to the New York Times. So I think they were feeling pretty good, but they also didn't know whether they could sing and dance.
Hmm.
So we looked at the existing members, and we really reached out further into the population at Sing Sing, which is a maximum security prison, and asked who else might like to come in and bring their talent and their genius to this production. And we brought in like 10 new men specifically who could sing and dance, and they went through a 4-week workshop with our director and our musical director, both professionals who volunteer their time, Peter Barbieri and Kim Breeden here in Westchester. And they looked at the men and they said, at the end of 4 weeks, we've got enough talent here to do West Side Story.
Well, I mean, you know, you're talking about the story of two gangs, so the casting, I guess, could be easy enough, but who sings I Feel Pretty?
Well, first of all, let me tackle the first part of it. It wasn't that easy to cast it because, you know, New York prisons are predominantly people of color, about 88%. African-Americans are about 55 and Latinos are 33. So casting the Latinos was not an issue. But we could not cast the traditional Jets as white.
Yeah.
So we cast them as mixed. And we had both white and black, and at one point even an Asian. And we played still. We kept to the words. We stayed with the full words, but we didn't have. It was not white against Latinos. It was a mixed Jets against the Sharks.
Okay.
And then you said, "I feel pretty."
I feel pretty. Yeah.
We cast 24 men into the roles, various gang members, and of course Krupke and Schrank. But we had five. outside female volunteers who are all actors or actresses in and who participated in the program.
And you yourself had to take a role, right?
I took, on purpose, a very small role. The director asked me to play one of the shark girls because in the original film, the sharks have a lot of girls hanging on. The jets do not, so they at least wanted to keep a couple of girls. So I played Consuela. I had about four lines. But I did get to sing background for I Feel Pretty and also in the Jets America, in the America America one.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Catherine Vokens. She's founder of the group Rehabilitation Through the Arts, which staged this music, West Side Story, at Sing Sing.
Pretty, oh so pretty. I feel pretty and witty and bright, and I pity any girl who isn't me tonight. I feel charming, oh so charming. It's alarming how charming I feel, and so pretty that I hardly can believe I'm real. See the pretty girl in that mirror there. Who can that attractive girl be? Such a pretty face, such a pretty dress, such a pretty smile, such a pretty me. I feel stunning and entrancing, feel like running and dancing for joy. For I know I am pretty, wonderful boy. Have you met my good friend Maria, the craziest girl on the block?
From Leonard Bernstein and Stephen Sondheim, West Side Story, the song I Feel Pretty, sung by Marnie Nixon, who was on Soundcheck not too long ago. We are speaking on the phone with Catherine Vokens, founder of Rehabilitation Through the Arts, which works with inmates at the Sing Sing Correctional Facility, maximum security prison upstate New York. We've also been speaking with 16-year-old Roxy Torres, who took part in the West Side Story project out in Seattle, which is all about youth violence prevention as well. And Catherine, I had asked Roxy before whether whether the story still seemed relevant to her. How did the inmates at Sing Sing relate to it when you presented them with this 50-year-old musical?
Well, every one of them knew about it, John. This is the West Side Story is a classic, and whether you were 24-year-olds inside of prison or you were 55-year-olds, all of which participate in our program, everyone knew the story. I think it's very relevant to the men because they could relate to the gang violence, they could relate to death, they could relate to guilt, they could relate to, like, the Krupke song that talked about how they're all bad guys, really.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, most people who are in at least New York State prisons where I know come from undereducated, poor families in the metro New York area. So, you know, you've got the urban environment and you've got the kind of life that these kids, whether they were having fun back in the 50s or serious, this is the life that many of these men have lived.
Now, West Side Story, you know, for all that it might be a familiar story, that's not easy music to play. Who played it?
Oh, well, you should have heard the conversation between our musical director, Kim Breeden, and our director, Peter Barbieri, about just that. We have extraordinarily good musicians at Sing Sing. I mean, really fine musicians. Some self-taught, some professionally trained on their own. But the complexity of the music being such that both of the directors decided to use the music, the score itself, rather than try to build up that kind of orchestra sound, which we couldn't really do inside of Sing Sing.
All right. Now, why use the theater in general, and I guess in this case a musical in particular, as part of a rehabilitation program?
Well, I guess the principles of the arts, we use that as a teaching principle. But, you know, the arts, if you are involved in, for instance, theater, you improve your literacy reading, you improve your communication, your presentation skills, the confidence and self-discipline that's required to be in a production, to go through 4 months of rehearsals and sitting around and working with people you might not work with. It's just like life on the outside. Theater provides the kinds of life skills that some of these gentlemen really need to relearn or to acquaint themselves with, and that's how you work in a team environment in a nonviolent way.
All right, Catherine Vokens is the founder of Rehabilitation Through the Arts, which has presented West Side Story at Sing Sing upstate. And we're joined now by Liz Wollman, professor of musical theater and popular music at Baruch College. Liz, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Hi, thank you for having me.
What do you think of this idea of West Side Story as, you know, a kind of a gang violence prevention technique in Seattle or rehabilitation in the prisons? Is it a good fit? Does it give kids and inmates the tools that they need?
I think in some ways that it does, and in some, you know, my job is to be sort of even-handed and historical, I suppose, but I think yes in certain ways, and what I'm hearing from both Roxy and from Catherine, and hello to you both, is that there are a lot of things about West Side Story that are still remarkably relevant, just as Romeo and Juliet still has a lot of things that are remarkably relevant, and that is one of the things that makes a classic, is that it can be handed down from generations and work with every generation. But there are certain things about West Side Story that make me wonder. One of the biggest being that in terms of its treatment of Latinos, I think that's one of the bigger issues with West Side Story through its history, that some people have, and I'm not saying across the board certainly, but this hasn't been raised by either Roxy or Catherine, so maybe I can open this up for a question back to them. But there is some question as to the treatment of Latinos as kind of reductivist or essentialized, you know, sort of like a pan-Latino experience as opposed to a distinctively Puerto Rican experience. And I just wonder if there have been Latinos involved in these programs that have raised objections or have had issues with this show.
Well, that's a really good question. Roxy, let me ask you first. You know, as someone of Filipino ancestry yourself, and presumably there are other Latino kids involved in this process, what did they think of that portrayal of the Latin gang?
I mean, oh, yeah. We had one of my classmates, Glory, she was Puerto Rican. I don't know, she didn't really say much about it, really, but, I mean, it's just that when we were watching movies, she, like, would understand what the words were whenever they talked in Puerto Rican or something.
But, and Catherine, from your point of view, I mean, you said that you were able to put together one of the gangs was all Latino, just, you
Correct.
Know, whether they were Puerto Rican or from other
or
parts
Dominican
of the
world. Exactly.
And you know, had they seen, I mean, did you show them the film before doing the production?
Yes, they did. And we did discuss it, you know, again, because we look at literature in the light of what it is for that period and that time. For instance, when we did a play about the use of the word nigger in American language and whatever, and a lot of people felt strongly one way or the other about it, but it seemed true to the nature of the play we were doing. And in this particular case, it is true to the nature of this particular play that it is, whether it's Puerto Rican or pan-Latino, it is still that's the portrayal 50 years ago. And we reminded the audience at Sing Sing ahead of time that the language and the use of, excuse me, spick, and the other words that are negative was in the language of the play, and that we were being true to the play. The Latino dissension was interesting. It had only to do with dancing the mambo. And that the Dominicans felt one way and the Puerto Ricans felt another way, and it was sort of interesting because that's when there would be a bit of arguing about which were the right steps.
Okay, so a different sort of regional differences in the approach to that dance form.
Absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about the music. Roxy, this is probably very different from the music that you normally listen to. What did you think about Leonard Bernstein's music?
I mean, it was just like, it was different. I mean, considering me, oh yeah, I listen to hip-hop or something like that, but mm-hmm. it was like there was meaning to the lyrics in like an easy sense.
Right.
So, and it was cool because then, you know, they were dancing with it, so it was pretty catchy. Because, you know, I would get like the song stuck in my head, like the America song.
That has been happening to people for 50 years. Liz, I mean, let's, you know, it's a 50-year-old piece now. I mean, let's... how interesting, how substantial a piece of music is West Side Story?
Oh, very substantial, I think. I mean, I have to just make it clear that it is one of my all-time favorites. It's something that I've just always grown up loving and really just cherishing the music too. I think it's beautiful, and I think that that's one of the things that has kept it. I mean, I don't mean to imply in my previous comments that that the show is not, you know, not at all relevant. I think that the one thing that's sort of dated, I think, is its sort of treatment of otherness, to be haughty and academic. But musically speaking, I think that they really did a beautiful job. Bernstein did a beautiful job, and Sondheim as well, I think, of trying very hard, not necessarily to be authentic so much, because really, what is authentic and what is authentic 50 years from then and 50 years from now, but really just they really sort of kept everything within their element. I think they were working from a really from a musical theater way, but the touches that they brought in and all of the ways that they sort of linked the score together, there's lots and lots of augmented fourths and lots of
lots of things for a musicologist to latch onto, as well as the lay audience.
Apologies. but yeah, a lot of, I think on many, many different levels, the music is appealing and beautiful and is studied over and over again, and forgive my lapsing into musicology.
I think that's a good place to leave it. Liz Wollman is professor of musical theater and popular music at Baruch College and author of The Theater Will Rock, A History of the Rock Musical. And we've also been speaking with Catherine Vokens, founder of Rehabilitation Through the Arts, which mounted a production of West Side Story at the Sing Sing Prison, and Roxy Torres, a 16-year-old from Seattle who participated in the West Side Story project, an effort by the Seattle police force there. To the three of you, thank you all for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Delighted to have been here.
With a click, with a shock, phone will jingle, door will knock. Open the latch, something's coming.